Thank you. Thank you. Thank you all for coming tonight. My name is Dick Young, and I am president of the board of Wonderlust. And I want to make a couple of comments about that. It's a lifelong learning program that's been going on here in Bozeman for about 10 years now. And we offer courses in conjunction with the Montana State University to help stimulate people's minds, particularly those that are over the age of 55, but we will take anybody at all who wants their mind stimulated. I would encourage you to pick up a brochure if you want to know more about us. We have membership and programs that are offered throughout the year, although mostly in a fall semester and then a winter-spring semester. But you'll get an idea of the kind of programs that we offer if you get a chance. I am delighted to welcome you tonight to this effort. We occasionally will open these up to the public, largely to sort of get our word out to a larger audience, but also when we have such a special program and group of people that we're going to have talking tonight, we would very much want to share that with as many people as possible. I'd like to now turn it over to Mary Dalabata. I certainly want to thank her because she arranged this whole program and got it all together, and she will introduce our panel.
Actually, I'm going to have you meet a marvelous woman in just a moment, and she's going to introduce the panel. But I do want to take a moment to say how this program came about. I just moved here in 2007, and as my family will attest, we just have a ton of visitors, don't we all, when we moved to Bozeman? Well, it seems like if they're here 2 days, the second day includes a trip to Livingston. And in so many correspondences back from friends, I keep hearing about that wonderful town of Livingston. Doing a little research, seeing a town of 7,500, 143 published authors, and on and on and on in the field of cinematography and every field, music, you name it. And so I propose to Wanderlust, how about we do a program about this magnificent little town through the past, and what was it that drew artists to Livingston area for so many decades? And now I'd like to introduce our moderator, Joanne Gardner. I had the pleasure of meeting Joanne. She was presenting another program at Wanderlust, and when I blithely volunteered to do this program about the wonderful artists from Livingston, I ran up sort of a lost creek. The first two contacts, one was in Arizona for the season, another one had closed up the gallery, was moving out of state, and so someone said, why don't you call Joanne? And so all of the work was done through Joanne Gardner. And if any of you have the opportunity, do yourself a favor and listen to this magnificent woman sing. She sang at the Baxter, I believe, in December, was
that? Just last month, too.
Just last month? And I was so impressed.
Tonight, don't worry.
I was so impressed that I went to hear her New Year's Eve in Livingston, and it was a night I'll never forget. It was magnificent. Joanne Gardner, go listen to her sing whenever you can.
Thank you very much. Thanks. We're not going to sing. We are going to sing tomorrow night if anybody's in Livingston. You kind of took my story, but I think it's everybody's story. I moved to Montana 6 years ago and had so much company immediately from L.A. They were all like, Montana, yes. But they didn't come for like a day. They came for like 2 weeks. And so the inevitable trip for me was through West Yellowstone, down through Old Faithful, back up through the park, stop and see the geysers, walk around on the, and then end up in Livingston. And the first night I ended up in Livingston at the Bar and Grill, James Crumley was standing at the bar, and he had a pot of something he'd made that had some game meat in it. And he had an eye patch. And he just seemed like the most interesting guy I ever saw in my life. And he was like, I don't know about women. And I thought, this is kind of fun. And then I went away. And then the next trip I came, same trip, West Yellowstone on the trip with the buses and the tourists. And then Bar and Grill. And the woman that was in the car with me that time was a set decorator for Superman 2, and she said, we have to come back here. And she shot every building in Livingston, and half the buildings in Livingston are in Spider-Man 3. She got all the cool old graphics. She was like, this is what we've been looking for, Americana. And then we went to the same bar and grill, watch for a trend. And I ran into a photographer that I knew. So I started thinking, what is it about this crazy town? So this has been an avocation for me too. What is it about this town? And I have some ideas. And it has to do with people who want their minds expanded. And luckily it has to do with people who are over 50. Because when it was time for me to move from that little town, I just went right past Bozeman because there were so many strollers here. And went right to Livingston. I mean, I like strollers. I do. I think they're lovely to have in a neighborhood. But I didn't want them in my neighborhood. So I'm going to introduce this panel to you, and all I can do is promise that I have no idea what's going to happen, but I think it's going to be really fun. In no apparent order, Clyde Aspevig is an extraordinary landscape painter. I can't wait for you to listen to both his stories about what influences him and his process in painting. We did a show with Clyde at the Danforth Gallery earlier this year, or he did a show with us, actually, thank you. And when he started talking about the importance of music in his art, it reminded me that all these senses work with each other, and that's part of the magic of Livingston. So this is Clyde Aspevig. Please come on up and have a seat. Thank you. Tim Cahill, who's got a brand new haircut that we're loving so much, but he hasn't actually seen. So everyone tell him, it looks great. It looks great. Is an amazing writer who writes very funny travel work. And if you aren't familiar with his books, please go into the back and pick some up. They will become your favorites. They will become the Christmas gift that you give everybody every year. They certainly have become that for me. Tim's got a lot of stories about his travels. Please come up and join us. Doesn't his hair look great? Please come up. Anywhere you want, baby. Carol Guzman. Of course. Carol Guzman is a very talented artist. Her work is here. She brought some giclées for you to look at and possibly take home. Her work hangs in galleries all over the world. And she also has a very interesting side project that we're going to let her talk to you about, which could involve all of you. So I can't wait for her to tell you about that. Carol Guzman, please come on up. Thank you for coming. Anywhere you want. Bill Payne is the best piano player in the world, end of story, really. Bill Payne is a founder and current member of the band Little Feet. He's been in the Paradise Valley for a very long time. He'll tell you exactly how long. Elton John says nice things about him, but everybody I know says nice things about him. He's an extraordinary keyboardist and an equally extraordinary photographer. This is our honor to have you up here, Billy Payne. Margot Kidder is my neighbor and my dear friend and an amazing actress that you may recognize as Superman's girlfriend. She's also been in a million movies, also theater and television, and she's a confirmed political activist and makes us all proud because she represents the things that we don't have the guts to go do. She was most recently arrested in front of the White House protesting against the Keystone Pipeline. Margot Kidder. Yes, and you are beautiful. And last but certainly not least, this is Scott McMillian, who is a longtime lifelong Montana resident and editor of, well, he's going to tell you everything he writes, but his most recent work is this fabulous Grizzly book, which is here in the back, and it's in its, which edition? Which edition is it now? It's a lot of editions. There seems to be no end to people who want to buy books about people who are stupid around bears. And so each year he gets more and more stories and he's able to come up with more and more editions. And we are so delighted at the stories and at the people who are being eaten by bears every year. So please come up, Scott McMillian. All right. so feel like a game show host with this thing, or like Oprah. So, I would love to go through each person and just ask a little bit, ask two questions. And so maybe I'll ask the first, how'd you get to Montana? That'll be the first question, and then I'll ask a follow-up question. Just tell us how you got to Montana. We'll just go down the row. Scott.
My mother brought me there.
Okay, perfect.
I was 6 months old. My mother was born in Montana. My grandmother was born in Montana. And my mother was in transit, and when I was 6 months old, she came home. That's how I wound up there. Grew up in Livingston. Didn't have much enthusiasm for that town at the time other than going outside, skipping school, and went to college at U of M, traveled around the world for about 10 years, and came back in my early 30s, and I'm not going anywhere.
We're glad. Bill, how'd you get to Livingston?
Well, I had been touring around the United States with the band Little Feet from about 1970, I'll say, and I'd never been to Montana. So just as a personal trip, I thought, well, I just want to drive up and go through the park and then go into Gardner, turn around, I could say, hey, I was in Montana. It turned out a few, some months later, I was looking at a National Geographic's great places in the United States, and I saw this Highway 89 and the corridor, and they mentioned Livingston. I thought, you know what, I'd like to check it out. I'd been looking for land for about 3 years. So in 1980, I came up, took a look at it, almost didn't make it because in a People magazine, it said that Jeff Bridges and Peter Fonda,
Ford.
All the gang were up here, Richard Brodigan. I said, hey, I am trying to get away from Hollywood. This is Hollywood comes to Montana. So when I finally got here, Dwayne Lindeman, God rest his soul, took me down to Valley, and as I was driving down, I went, I don't think I'll ever see any of these people. I didn't meet Jeff Bridges until about 6 to 8 months ago, so that's 31 years later.
And he's a perfectly nice man.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, I grew up in a small town in Wisconsin and lived in San Francisco for 12 years, where I worked for Rolling Stone magazine and Outside magazine. Rolling Stone went to New York, and I stayed in San Francisco and worked for Outside. Outside moved to Chicago, which is just 100 miles south of where I grew up, and I damn sure didn't want to move there. So I researched all the states, and Montana was the one that didn't have a warrant out for my arrest. I'd been to Livingston for the total eclipse of the sun, which was in 78, I think. And there I met people that worked for Outside Magazine. And as my capacity as an editor, I met Tom McGuain, Richard Brodigan, and William Yartsburg. And when Outside moved the next year, I said, well, maybe I could move to Livingston. I mean, you know, I'll give that a try. So that was 78. I can't do the math. That's a lot of years since. Mm-hmm. Yeah, 33 years ago, I guess. Yeah, that's my story. I'm sticking to it.
I don't know which one here. I'm going to try this. I moved for the same reason that most young people move. I fell in love. I was living in L.A. Acting, and I just started directing and went on an audition and fell madly in love with a writer from Livingston, Montana, who was directing his own book and had one of those sort of passionate Taylor Burton half hell, half heaven romances, and moved up here, and it pretty quickly became clear I was supposed to be the wifey and worship the great artist and be second. He was the god and I was the peon or something. It was chauvinism. And so there was, that wasn't going to work. He's a wonderful man and a wonderful writer, but we were seriously mismatched. We had a wonderful daughter in Livingston. I had her in Livingston Memorial Hospital. I think I was the loudest birthing mother in Livingston Memorial Hospital. And then when it was clear we weren't going to make it, and I'd met all these wonderful people here, writers and painters and people. I'd met Scott. You had came right after, I think. I was in that horrible article in People magazine. It wasn't a terribly nice one about Livingston. And but it was pretty wild. Livingston was way wilder than L.A. or New York at that time in the 70s.
Yes,
it was crazy. There were plane loads of drugs flying in. There was stuff going on in the bars you can't begin to describe. And I thought, this is so strange, this little town in Montana. Whoa. At any rate, the marriage fell apart. I moved away with my daughter. Cut to, I don't know how many years later, she was at college at Sarah Lawrence, and she called me. I was then living in Prague in the Czech Republic, and she said, I'm quitting college. I'm falling in love with a writer from Livingston, Montana, and I'm moving back. Would you come help me plan the wedding? So I said, yes, of course I will, and came back. And all sorts of friends were still here, and I looked around, and I went, oh, my God, this is the most gorgeous place on earth, and look at these wonderful people, and announced to her and her soon-to-be husband that I was moving back. The poor guy, he was just like, oh, the mother-in-law, great. So I moved back, and now she's three blocks away with my grandchildren. I've been back 16 years this second go-round. The first time was about two and a half. And I love it, and I plan on dying there, and there's just no place like it on earth as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah.
Well, first I must say that we don't live in Livingston. Clyde and I.
Yeah, but we let you in.
We live in the Shields Valley. And
it's
the
a foreign country, by the way.
Right north of Clyde Park, and one of the first towns that we go to, that we went to when we moved here, would be Livingston. And the thing that was so beautiful about Livingston, well, first of all, I'm from St. Louis, and I moved out of St. Louis in 1978, moved to New York City, and I lived in New York City and had a studio in New York City and worked as an editorial illustrator in New York City. And I left New York City in 1990, and I decided I wanted to be an old hippie. So I bought...
Perfect spot.
I bought a van, and I traveled around the country and lived out of my van with my Jack Russell Terrier for almost a year. I had a futon, I had a bicycle, I had my climbing equipment. Yeah, I was having a ball. And I made myself go to Montana from, I was in Idaho and I was heading north, and I entered Montana and it rained for 2 weeks straight. If anybody can remember 1990, there was so much rain. So I just kept driving this pouring rain up through the Bitterroots and up through Darby, and I finally made my way to Glacier Park, and it was still raining, and I was trying to hike, and I hiked up to Grinnell, and it was in the fog, and finally ended up in Canada, and the sun came out, and I was so happy to be in Canada because it wasn't raining. I thought, God, Montana, forget it. It's horrible. And then I ran into Clyde Aspavig painting in the Canadian Rockies, and we fell in love.
There you go.
And he's from Montana.
Well, so I'm responsible for all that. It was a great meeting. But I guess my story, how did I get here? Well, my grandfather actually came into Livingston in 1909 from Norway, and he was 16, didn't speak any English. And he worked in the expansion of the Roundhouse, and then he went to Cook City and then Butte, and then up to the High Line where I was born and raised. And I've been angry ever since. I mean, and maybe it's just Norwegians, I don't know. But he could have homesteaded in Paradise Valley. I could have had a big ranch, Paradise Valley, but I don't. And so this whole connection, my uncle was a superintendent in Wilsall back in the 1950s. And some of the people, when I moved into the valley, and they kind of let me move in because I was an artist. And, you know, the Shields Valley is a very kind of unique place, close to Bozeman, but remote. There's still Bozeman people here that, you live way over there? But anyway, that's how I ended up in the Shields. But Montana has always been my home. When I was gone for a little while, I'd come back up. I've left for about 13 years in another time in my life. But every time I came up and stopped to get some gas, I had Colorado plates on, and it was so embarrassing. And I get out and I tell the attendant, I'm really from Montana. You know? Carol knows that.
I showed up in a BMW with California plates and a Prada coat and a cell phone. But everybody was so welcoming.
So anyway, that's, and when I came back to Montana, I just said, you know, I wanted to be somewhere in southern Montana. I was a little tired of the wind, so I couldn't quite, growing up in the High Line, we get our face blown off up there too. And it's a little colder most of the time. So I didn't want to live right in Livingston, and I wanted to be someplace in a Montana paradise. So that's how we ended up in the Shields Valley. But we still feel like we're a part of Livingston.
Well, so people make art all over the country, all over the world, and they make it in small studios, and they make it in tall buildings, and they make it in Kansas, for God's sake. I'm sure somebody does. I'm sure they do. But can you guys each talk in any order that you want about how the place that you live influences the art that you create or what you bring to what you do? I mean, do you, certainly visually, but I think I'm wondering if some of you, music and writing, whether you're influenced by your place. Tim?
Well, I've been a writer before I moved to Livingston, and I have to say my process is precisely the same. But it's what I like. I hear people from larger cities say, well, we have the operas and we have the museum and we have a symphony orchestra, and I really honestly couldn't live in a place that didn't have those things. And I can understand what they're saying. Those are wonderful things to have. You have all of them in Bozeman. But I like the rivers and the mountains and the fishing. And my life would be a lot different if I didn't live in a place that offered that kind of solace to my So, you know, I can recall the first book that I wrote in Livingston was, it didn't involve a lot of humor. It was about a serial killer in Chicago. And I have to say that it was not very psychologically, part of the process of that book was to try to get into the mind of this particular person. I spent 3 years doing it, and it was a very sick place to be. And the only healing I had was out my front door. That's what Livingston did for me.
Scott, do you have a sense about that? I mean, you've been here since you were a child, so maybe it's hard to... But you left.
Yeah, I left. I was glad to get out of town when I was 18. But I'm really glad that I'm back. I think Livingston for me is a sense of place. I think I could do what I'm doing In a number of places, but I would miss the connections that I have. I mean, I go for walks most days, and some blocks on almost any block in town, I can tell you a story about that. Something that happened there. I know somebody who lived in that house. Some neighborhoods, I can tell you something about every house. They're not always pleasant stories. But they're sort of the ghosts that walk around with me in town, and I've become quite attached to them. When I came back, I'd been living in the Far East and other places for several years, and when I came back, these ghosts sort of scared me, that familiarity that they brought, and it took a while to get used to them. And now I'm pretty familiar with them, pretty comfortable with them. Now and then one jumps up and says, boo. But that sense of place, and I've applied that to my work by trying to understand what makes Montana tick, what makes it work economically, politically, environmentally, socially. And I think that without that grounding that I have in Livingston, it would be harder for me to do. Even though I don't write about Livingston that much anymore, it gives me a base of understanding that's very valuable.
Mm-hmm. Clyde, can you talk about what this place does for you?
Well, I think, Livingston to me has got a very bohemian flavor. I really like the idea of getting together with other artists, with people, creative people. And I think Scott and I were talking about this the other night. It's not an insult to say that Bozeman is very different than Livingston. And Bozeman is full of a great academia, of all kinds of different wonderful people. And I have my feet in both communities almost equally. I love Bozeman. But when you go to Scott's house, for example, on a weekend, and all of his friends are there, and you start talking, there's just a different type of feeling. And I've never been to a town that small with that many people who know how to cook.
That is true.
Because I'm telling you, the food in Livingston is sensational. It is. It's all. And so, I think from that sense, you just feel there's this kind of very unique camaraderie there that you don't find in bigger areas. And when you look at, we've traveled a lot. Every time I come back, there's definitely a grounding there that you really feel. And from an art standpoint, having that kind of connection with all kinds of different creative people is really, really essential to, constantly feeding new ideas and exchanging ideas with that same type of mindset. So I think that's one of the reasons I like Livingston a lot.
Marty?
Other than the fact that, you don't have to worry about population explosion there. it has its own elements that keep it that way. And I think just look at it. If it weren't for Bozeman Pass, if it weren't for the geographical features, if Livingston were part of this big Gallatin Valley, it wouldn't be Livingston. And so that's the other thing I really enjoy about it. 22 miles is like night and day sometimes. And you just can't get away from the diversity of landscape. When people come to visit and we go for a hike and you say, oh yeah, there's the castles, the crazies, the bridges, the absorcas, and wait a minute, I've never seen that much beauty just stacked on top of these layers and layers. And that's what Livingston is. It's layers and layers of ranchers, of railroad people. It's just so diverse and so small, so it's accessible. And I like that.
Margie, do you have one?
Yeah, what I love, and the reality of the beauty is all there in the wilderness areas, and I'm picking my dog hair off my dress, and everybody has dogs, which is great. But for me, it's the people, and there's an extraordinary sense of community. So if you're sick, there's chicken soup on your door. People really do pitch in. It's smart, small enough that the artsy types have to get along with the ranchers and the merchants and the lawyers. It really is a community in a way that's very rare. But I think one of the reasons it's such a strong community, I don't know how many people here have lived in Europe or France or England or even at one point Canada, although not so much now. North Americans or Americans tend to, more than anywhere else in the world, want everyone to be normal and happy and cheerful. And it doesn't worship eccentricity the way other countries tend to, except for Livingston, which is the Soho of Montana. And eccentrics in Livingston, which you have several up here trying to act normal.
You guys are doing a great job.
Are truly, really welcomed and embraced in a way that they just aren't in a lot of small towns. And that makes you free to be free to be you and me or whatever that horrible book was, but you really are. And so there's a community of eccentrics, and you're not seen as odd. You're seen as somebody with this particular quirk or that particular quirk. And I find that really reassuring. I'll tell you a little story. I had a big nervous breakdown, and it was in public 16 years ago. It was horrible. It was all in the papers, and it was a nightmare. And I drove back thinking I'm going to get to Livingston, and I'm going to have to wear a bag over my head for quite some time. Ran into Scott, ran into several people, and almost every person in Livingston said, "Oh, you know, that happened to me," or they said, "My husband did that," or everybody had a story they could tell me about sometime in their life or something. I went, "Okay, I'm home. This is it. This is where I belong and can fit in." So there's a delightful myriad of colors that go into the pot in that town, and it's too small for us all not to get along, but just big enough to embrace all of those different things without cutting them up into different groups. So it really is heaven.
We want to hear from Bill.
I think if you're going to live in Livingston and be happy and accepted, you have to acknowledge that we are all deeply flawed. And since we are all deeply flawed, we all have to be deeply forgiving.
Bill, do you have any comment on, are we really that different from the people you run into out in the world?
Well, I do most of my living on a bus when I'm not in town. I live down the Tom Minor Basin, so I continue to be a carpetbagger wherever I go. I was born in Waco, Texas, Waco as I call it. And tell a stint of 33 years in California, Los Angeles, playing on records of every make and variety. So when I'm out on the road, I'm with my family, which is Little Feet. I've toured with James Taylor, Linda Ronstadt, Jackson Brown, Stevie Nicks, Emmylou Harris, Bonnie Raitt, to name a few. And so when I come back to the Tom Minor Basin, and I've only been living up here for a couple of years, but out of the 33 years before the mast in Los Angeles, 22 of them I had a place up in Montana. I'm here with my wife, Polly. People go, "God, we never saw you up here before." I said, "Well, I came up here to get away from things, not to integrate." So the 2 years I spent integrating since coming back to Montana, everything these folks are saying is true, but for me, I slip into town. I've got Emmylou Harris's piano in my one part of my house. It's a 7-foot Yamaha, played on her first couple of albums. And I've written probably 9 songs with Robert Hunter in the last 4 months, 4 or 5 months. Robert wrote a lot of stuff with Jerry Garcia, with the Grateful Dead. I do it because of the solitude of... Tim was talking about the solace of being in an area like Livingston. But for me, it's being in a place where I wake up, I look at Yankee Jim Canyon, and what I told the realtor, that my guess was 31 years from now or 30 years from now at that point, I'd still have the same view, not when I walked up to the ledge, but from where I saw this house. I still have that. So it's the quiet is what I deal with. It leaves a lot of vacuum to if you're concerned with ghosts and whatnot, which we all have. The longer we live, there's living and imagined and all these things. So I don't feel like I'm, maybe my noise level in life is so high-pitched when you're on essentially a Coca-Cola can with 10 other guys, 11 people going around the world. I get home, I kind of relax, I break out my Kindle, I've got a great library in addition to that. And the solitude is what allows me to sort of re-energize and rethink what I'm doing. And I'm a very visual person, which I imagine most of these people on stage are too. That really helps inform your art. It informs who you are as a person. It allows you to view the demons that each and every one of us have hovering about us and occasionally take over our lives at times. And like Margie said, it's the water's warm up here. It's a cold place, but it's a warm environment in terms of human beings. There's plenty of beautiful spots in the world. I've seen a lot of them, but it's always boils down to the people. That's what makes a community click, and it's what artists, it's what makes and informs their art. You don't write in a vacuum.
Carol, do you make different art here than you may have had you stayed in your van or in St. Louis?
Well, first I'd like to tell a story about Livingston, since we're talking
Absolutely.
About how Livingston has influenced our lives. Clyde and I love to travel, and one of the first things we do when we go into a town is we go to the bookstore. And, you know, we collect art books, and we're always looking for, you know, that treasure artist that we didn't know anything about, and we find them. Anyway, we come to Livingston, and we find Saxon Friar. And we walk into Saxon Friar, and it has a feeling of a really old bookstore. It is a really old bookstore. And we wander around, and Clyde's in heaven, and I'm in heaven. We're looking through books, and he's buying, you know, putting books on the counter. I want this one, and I want this one. They have Western books. They have art books. They have just a ton of different types of books. And they have art supplies, too. And we get ready to leave. We spend about an hour there, and Clyde whips out his credit card and plops it on top of the books. And John says, "No, we don't take credit cards." And he said, "Well, I just spent an hour picking out all these books, and what are we going to do? I don't have any cash." He said, "Well, just take the books and send me a check." And he goes, "No, but you don't understand. We don't live here. We live in Colorado." He said, "Just take the books and send me a check." And we said, "This is kind of cool. We can get a lot of books for nothing." No, we didn't think that. But we felt that just by going into this bookstore that this person had this, you know, and John is a very wonderful person, and he's sort of the tentacles. And you go in there, and you can find all the Montana writers in there. And that's what really attracted us. And then we just, and that was when we were in Colorado, and then we moved here, and it just kept expanding and meeting people that weren't necessarily visual artists, you know, musicians and writers.
John wanted to show her his saddle collection in the basement.
Yeah.
That's what John was
anyway.
Up to.
Yeah.
You can also write a check and ask for $20 back, and you'll get it.
But he really does have a saddle collection.
He doesn't have any credit cards. He can't even...
No computer.
No computer. He has an old adding machine. You know, that's...
bills come handwritten.
Yeah.
Yes.
Handwritten.
Absolutely.
Does it? I remember walking through the town and being hit with the sense that there was all this stuff here, just hanging. Every building had a story. Every alley had a story. And then I would run into people, and they'd say, "Well, yeah, Peckinpah used to live up there," and he would shoot at people. And I heard more stories, which I still don't know which are true and which are false, but I love them all so very much. Anybody have a favorite story? Doesn't even have to be true.
Joe was his lawyer. Joe has a lot of stories. Wow.
He's dead now,
and
Joe.
And Sam needed a lawyer.
I bet he did. Anybody have a favorite story about a Livingston character that they want to share?
Oh, who knows? You wouldn't know where to start.
I know, but they're fun. Let's tell some.
There was a bar in Livingston that was frequented by writers and bikers, for the most part. It was the Owl. It's closed now, sadly. But the bartenders and owners were solicitous of their customers, and they made sure that that people had a good time, that women were treated well. And there was one fellow who came in quite often, and his job was welding at nuclear plants around the world. And when he had a few drinks, he would talk about welding, which would be interesting for the first 15 minutes. But after about 2 hours, you kind of wanted to get away from this guy we called Nuclear Rick. And one day the bartender came over and told him that he was 86. He could no longer come into the Owl Bar because he was too boring.
Kiss of death, man. Kiss of death.
Well,
could you tell us, Scott, the tiniest little bit of history of just, if anybody doesn't really know how Livingston got to how it, I mean, the history of the railroad and the little bit of the cut thing? Everybody got that? Okay, that's two things.
Well, the railroad came in 1880s. My great-grandfather's first job off the boat from Prussia was working on the roundhouse, stacking bricks there. Provided a lot of jobs for about 90 years, and then in 1986, Burlington Northern just sort of pulled out, and that it was a severe blow to the community. That's also the same year that the Church Universal of Triumphant came into Park County. For those of you who've been around for a while, you remember things were tense for a while. That's all or mostly gone away, which I think is a good thing. The church hasn't gone away. They're still there. They're smaller, but I think a lot of the animosity has disappeared. I think in the early days of the church, they wanted to have a self-sufficient community, shape the local political institutions to their liking. And I think what wound up is Montana shaped the church more than the church shaped Montana. And I think that's probably good for all parties. And everybody gets along well. You never hear anybody say anymore, "Well, I don't go in there, that's a church store." I mean, it's not even an issue anymore. And in large part, they helped the economy. They brought in several hundred people at a time when several hundred people were leaving. So they made a difference. But they're just, you know, one more set of oddballs in Park County. They're no weirder than anybody else anymore.
They fit right in. Well, that's what they told me when I moved here, because I was single, and they said, "Well, you know, odds are good in Livingston."
And goods are odd.
But the goods are odd in Livingston. And I thought, well, okay. They were totally right. So
it's also old oddballs. I mean, one of the things about living in the Livingston, I can tell by the hair color, no offense, but an older group. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that happens when you've lived in Livingston and you go away, you go to London, and you go, "Good grief, everyone's young here." And I think the baby boomers basically are, tell me if I'm wrong, Scott, the the biggest part of the population. And so it's wonderful for us because we kind of, I don't know if we run things as much as we get to think we're still 30. I don't know what it is. And behave as such. I want to add, in terms of what Scott was saying, is one more nuts. I had a stalker for a while, and the mayor offered to shoot him, and I thought, nowhere else but Livingston would the mayor come up, the unofficial mayor. This was way back. You know who I mean, the guy who stripped down in the bar and got the police came.
No, he was the mayor.
He really was
the mayor.
See, now the real stuff's coming out. And I'd applied for a big fence and didn't get it. And so he came up at a party, and after trying to French kiss me, he said, "You know what? Don't that guy comes around, we'll take care of him." And I went, no, not like that. And he was very serious in his offer. But anyway, so there are a lot of boomers, for those of you who are older. And there are times when we have gatherings where everyone plays wonderful music and Joanne will sing and somebody will be playing something else. And we feel a really strong link to those wonderful 60s and 70s that were, to us, so unique and so special.
Well, let me tell one more about the mayor. He was in court for one more drinking offense. I don't remember which one it was. And the judge said, "Mike, that's going to be $150 and another 50 because you haven't shoveled your walk all winter."
That's strict.
To go back to what you were asking about how it helps your process or something, I'm going to start with a little thing that weightlifters are told. When you try to lift a heavier weight over your head, you have to tense all of your muscles from the bottom of your legs through your core, and then lift, because you need a solid base. They say you cannot shoot a cannon from a canoe. Well, for those of us that are shooting our cannons in terms of art or music or writing, Livingston is our solid little base. That's what helps us do it. That's why we're here. That's what you've heard from everyone so far. You can't shoot a cannon from a canoe.
And Tim will come to a dinner party and do wonderful demonstrations of, they're not barbells, what are they?
Kettlebells.
Kettlebells over his head, under, you're sure he's going to knock himself out, so there's a great deal of suspense in it, and it's a really fun show if any of you want to see it.
Well, see, this leads me to what I think is another reason that Livingston is so special, and you guys don't have this over here. I know you have windy days over here, but you don't have wind over here. You don't have trains blown over. You don't have, it's no big deal to see semis on the front of the paper on their side. It's like, whatever, Tuesday. So when I first moved here, I was told you work in the winter and you play in the summer. And almost, I think Jim Harrison told me that. Yeah, the deal is you work in the winter so you can play in the summer. And I'd love to have you guys talk about, I don't know if you do that.
A lot of work playing in the
there's
winter.
There's a lot of playing in the winter. I did notice that too. Yeah. But I wonder how wind has affected your world. Does it really scour the lightweights out?
Absolutely. It keeps real estate values down. I mean, just look around in Livingston. Like today was a stunning bluebird day, not a cloud in the sky, not a breath of wind. If we didn't know it was coming back, there'd be 50, 60,000 people living around there. It'd be a very different community. And every place I go in Montana, somebody says, "Well, how do you take the wind?" I say, "Oh, we don't. It's awful. Don't come." But I think it keeps real estate values down, makes it more economically livable. And it's also a little source of pride, you know. Keeps the riffraff skittering east. And And, you know, if you don't have some sand in your pockets, you're not going to make it around there.
Yeah, I was in Hawaii in October. I got married over there. And I met some folks that I'm not sure if they're from, I think they're from California. That had to be it. And that's exactly what they brought up, was the wind. And I said, yeah, it's, you know, it's pretty severe. But I said, I like it, but it's not for everybody. And where'd you guys say you were from? You know, it was...
Right.
These are guys that are out there playing golf. And, I mean, you play golf at that little... the Livingston course, and you hit the ball, and it goes about 50 yards. And if you got the wind at your back, it's going to go 200. So it's all okay. I grew up in Ventura, California. There is not as much wind, but when it was, for me, that was something magical. So when Jimmy Buffett, who I worked with for about 3.5 years, he says, how do you take the dust up there? I said, well, like you say, you don't. You deal with it, and I'm thinking, how the hell do you live in Florida? I mean, it's flat, there's, you know, et cetera, so on. Now, I love it up here. It's, for a guy that came here quite in a very circuitous manner, it really feels like home to me. And, but it has to do with the wind, the people, that feeling, you know. And I mean, I've spent 2.5 days in town since December 23rd. So the rest of it was in New York City, it was in the East Coast, it was in Jamaica, stepped into Nashville with Emmylou Harris and Rodney Crowell on the way home for 3 or 4 days, and then came out here, went out to Big Sky, went home for the 2.5 days, over to Targhee to sit in with some other band, down to 3.5 weeks in L.A. to finish mixing a record, and got home about 2 days ago. So... it's home. I love it.
You got a wind story, Tim?
Well, I've written several wind stories.
And there's some in those books on
about
the back table.
I can tell you that Livingston, by some accounts, is the third windiest town in America. People ask, what are the others, of course? And second is Casper, Wyoming, and third is Borrego Pass, New Mexico. It's the wind. When I did my first wind story about Livingston, it was before you could look stuff up on the internet. Came over here to the MSU library and found that the wind does indeed have a psychological effect. A pharmacologist named Felix Schulman, who worked in the Sharaf, the wind of Israel, tested wind-sensitive patients and found out that, rather like the wind in Italy that they call the Scirocco. Whenever anybody sticks an ice pick into their neighbor's neck for no particularly good reason, the lawyer will plead the Scirocco. And you often see that in Livingston during a blow. It's generally...
the ice pick?
No. The phenomenon. It'll be a woman walking along the street. The wind will be... and there's a pickup going very slowly next to her, and there's a guy leaning out the passenger seat from the holding the steering wheel, going very, very slowly, and he's saying something like, "I said I'm sorry, just get into the truck, God damn it."
I have noticed how, so you guys mentioned this before, how astonishingly diverse the cooking, the singing. It just feels like in the winter we hunker down and we survive. And we do that with much good nature. And it reminded me that the story that you told at the gallery about your process when you're out in a beautiful landscape and when you go home then to translate that,
how you create the mood to get that out of your head and onto paper. And again, while it's not exactly Livingston-centric, it speaks to that melding of senses that you use to paint. And I really encourage you guys to come look at these paintings because they're extraordinary. You want to talk about that?
How the wind affects my painting?
No, the wind. We're over the wind now, Clyde. We're over the wind. We're done with the wind. Forget the wind.
Oh, but I had a wind story.
Oh, well.
No.
Oh.
My procedure is very traditional. And one of the reasons I like this area, especially Montana, is that when I go out to paint, most of the time I can find a place where I'm alone. Unless it's, you know, used to be in Yellowstone, I was painting there years ago, and this was back in the 70s, and I climbed down onto Artist Point there where you're not supposed to go, you know, you're supposed to stay up there. And I had a little ranger come up to me and say, you can't be here. And I said, why not? And he said, well, you're beyond the barrier and everything. And I said, where are you from? Where'd you grow up? New Jersey. And I said, well, I grew up here, and I have a license to do this. And we had this little argument. So I kept painting. And then I heard this noise, and I turned around, and I thought I was the only one there. It was the end of October, and I turned around, and here's this tour bus, all these Japanese tourists, and they're all taking pictures of me on Artist Point. But, you know, the things that have happened in Montana, I'll be out painting some, I'll just kind of divert here a little bit, but in some of these valleys, I'll be painting, a rancher will come up and say, do you want me to put some more hay out for the horses? You know, on the other hand, and then I had another guy, this was a wonderful story, I would sit in my van to get out of the wind, and it gave me a little more privacy, especially when it was cold. So one day, this guy comes up in his John Deere tractor, you know, putt, 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 to see if I needed some help, thought it was broke down or something. And he looks in, see what I'm doing. Oh, what are you doing? Well, I'm painting. Oh, you're painting. They always, you know, it's pretty obvious. I always get that. I had some smart aleck remarks for that one years ago, but I quit doing it. So he looks at it, and then he looks out at what I was painting, and I just kind of started the process of what we call blocking in. And he just had this puzzled look on his face, and I could tell. He thought, man, this guy's nuts. So I said, well, why don't you come back in about an hour? And sure enough, I hear his tractor, put, 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 and he gets off, and he sticks his head in, and he looks at it, and he looks at what I was painting, and he says, do you mind if I go get the missus? And, you know, so all of those experiences, I can still remember every painting I've ever done outside. When I get it in, even 20 or 30 years later, I keep a lot of them in my studio, and they're like a visual diary. I go back to that, and when I'm compiling doing my larger paintings in the studio in the winter most of the time so I can play in the summer, that's what I use, and those memories just keep creeping back and forth, and it's a great experience. I'm actually walking through the painting with all these memories. And so that really enhances, I think, all of the different senses and qualities that I can bring into the work. So, no.
And you actually remember you talked about music and the way that you integrate music when you paint. I thought that was interesting.
Well, the aspect of music is it's something that's innate. Painting is innate. It's something we have to do. We've been making music and dancing and being creative for thousands and thousands of years. This is something we have to do as human beings. So I've been working very hard. Even though I paint representational, I played piano when I was a kid, and I've, you know, like most people, I have to have music in my life. So art is the same way, but it's expressed in different ways. And so I've tried to integrate a lot of musical ideas in my paintings, and in this little book that Scott helped me on, he cleaned up my crude writing, and made it presentable. And it's all about how I use the syncopation of notes in terms of how I organize shapes and paintings, because I think it relates back to our evolutionary beginnings. And it's something that I don't think we teach enough of in our schools, because it teaches us how to think in abstract and cognitive terms, and it really is something that is a complete understanding of the interconnectedness of all these different things that we experience in our lives. So that's
very cool. I hate that I interrupted your wind story, Carol. You got to let a Montana girl tell a wind story. If you got one, go for it.
Well, I learned in Livingston that we learned that you can't open both car doors at the same time. The wind is blowing because you lose everything in the car. And we had some friends from visiting us from Colorado, and he just bought this brand new cowboy hat. And he had it on the dashboard of his car, of his truck. And they opened, and we're going, no, no, don't do that. They're, you know, checking into the Murray Hotel. Don't, oh my gosh. Sure enough, the brand new white cowboy hat blows out of the car, rolls down the street, and a truck stopped right before he. But the wind is something that affects you, and we don't get the wind in Quai Park. We have a lot of friends that come up and visit us from Livingston.
Get out of the wind.
And they come up and they get out of their car and they look around and they they say, wow, it was really blowing in Livingston. We said, yeah, that's why we don't live there. But you know what I love about Livingston, too, is watching that wind sock on the highway. Today it was limp. You very rarely see it like that. And I'm wondering, who is that guy that gets out there and puts that windsock out? And I want to know how long those windsocks last, because they really do. I mean, after about a few weeks, they start getting raggedy on the edges, and then they get holes in them. And then pretty soon somebody comes and puts a brand new one up. So I think that the mascot or the logo of Livingston should be a windsock.
That's a good idea. Right.
Well, and the other thing that we love when we drive into Livingston is to see how long the new signs last. I really love it. And I mean, that's quite a force, because, I mean, these are, and they're just mangled and twisted, and they go, yeah.
And you learn really quickly that insurance will not cover you when you're opening your car door at the dog park to get out and the wind slaps it absolutely frontwards and off the hinges. That's not covered by insurance. You should know that if you move to Livingston.
No matter how cold it is, open your window before you open the door. I'll tell you one quick story about the wind. When I first moved to Livingston, I lived outside of town, about 7 miles under Mount Livingston. And when I moved into the house, it was the only house that I've ever decorated by hanging pictures here and here and here to cover the various bullet holes. And the bathroom door was a hollow core door, but it was a triumph of local color decorating. There was a shotgun blast through the middle of it, about this big, and then it expanded. And then there were pellets that had bounced around in the tub, and I thought, my goodness, what was going on here? Well, presently, after several months, I realized that it was fairly windy, and that the winds would conspire up there on top of Mount Livingston and then come down, and it would be a 3-day blow. I once wrote a thing saying, the wind boomed and whistled, and the copy editor in New York says, wind does not boom. Oh, yeah, it does. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. You always do that. All right. I had a TV antenna in those days, and it would set the TV antenna to humming. And I had three dogs, and they would howl along with it, and the wind would whistle and boom outside. And I finally sort of understood why people started shooting guns in the house.
Which they did.
Sorry.
A lot.
Yeah. Well, I thought I'd seen everything in Livingston. Just last winter, I rescued two old ladies that were walking down the street and obviously having a hard time, and little tiny ladies, and I said, "Man, you need some help." And they said, "Please." So I had to go get a car and take them wherever they were going. One had three stops to make. But I thought I'd seen everything until just this winter. I was up in Browning, which gets a little wind too, and I was in a cheap motel up there and went into the bathroom, and the wind was coming down the vent pipe so hard there were actually white caps in the toilet. And I went about my business the next day, and I told a couple people who live there, I said, "There were white caps in the toilet last night." And they said, "Yeah." So we're not alone.
Occasionally we'll call each other on a Saturday night when some of us are at the Murray Hotel, and we'll call each other and say, "Hey, it's a Livingston night." And typically what that means is ranchers are dancing with tattooed girls with rings in their noses, and swing dancers from Bozeman, and real estate agents, and Bible salesmen, and hippies, and children. And that's kind of a perfect analogy of Livingston. Everybody's there. Everybody gets along. It really is the most extraordinary place I've ever lived. You guys want to have one final Livingston tale, and then we'll see if anybody has a question? Or actually, we've said everything we can think of. We're completely out of stories. You want to do that? Anybody have a question? You do.
Well, it's nice to be blown away there by Livingston. Seems to have left out one thing I love about that town. Can you address authenticity?
Authenticity.
We made it up.
He's very sincere about that.
I'll take a step. I mean, Tim, when Tim and I were driving over tonight, we weren't quite sure what to talk about. And I said, "Well, you know, there's an artistic community. I don't know. It's if there's a salon in Livingston, they never invited me." And Tim made the very good point that, well, there may be an artistic community, but first you've got to be part of the community.
Yeah.
And I think that's where the authenticity comes from. You got to be real. There's not a lot of room for artifice. We get plenty of fakers and sham artists that come through, and most of them don't last.
Very nice. Scott can tell a story about the infamous Marina fire.
Oh, Floyd, I didn't see you come in.
Here, here.
Urana Clark was the probably the tiniest hero in Montana, a little wisp of a woman, maybe 80 pounds, who she died 10 years ago, maybe, was about 94, showed up at every city council meeting, every meeting of any import, and just never stopped until everybody did what she wanted. And
just asked her what she wanted. Did it.
Yeah. And as Floyd once described her, he said, "You always feel like she's trying to pick your pocket, and then you reach in there and you found out she's put a little Chopin in there." And that was Urana Clark.
No, she had, I wish I knew her history of the famous people that she'd known throughout her life. She was, when I knew her, she was a piano teacher that lived out on the island. And I never did get her story. If somebody has it, I'd love it. But.
Anybody have a question? You do.
I just have a comment. Someone suggested, you're in Southern California and wanted to get out. They said, go to this place at Chico Hot Springs. It's in Prey, Montana. So we thought, what is that? It's a resort. So we went to this resort. I know resorts. It tricked me. And I had an infant and a toddler. And my husband went fly fishing, which later we ended up buying the fly fishing place there. But I said, is there some place I can go, something to do? And you know, we have to go to Bozeman. I said, well, there's a town, Livingston. And the girl goes, nobody goes to Livingston. And it's funny because that was May of 88. Raining. Oh, it rained the whole time. And we ended up moving and buying an old house that was a first bed and breakfast, the town house bed and breakfast. And you guys failed to mention all the movies with Jack Palance there, and Brooke Shields was there, and of course Patrick Markey and Brad Pitt. It was a wild time back then. And I think the newspaper just had an article about the first one she wrote. But everybody thought I was with the CUT. My daughter's name was Elizabeth. My favorite color was purple. We moved from Southern California. He said, what's that? And somebody said, it's a cult. And my husband goes, we're here to start a row. So that this time. But it was a great town. It still is, but I'm a Wilson right now.
We still invite you over whenever.
I'm there for next week.
It's rare that we'll go a few months without seeing a camera crew in town. And they're from all over the world. They come all the time and just walk around. You can tell them because they run into stuff. They're just looking. And then they just hit stuff. It's always fun to watch. Anybody else have a question? Comments? Requests? I would love to encourage you guys to look at Tim and Scott's books in the back. Country Bookshelf brought them over. These authors have a huge body of work. We also have an amazing author in our midst tonight. Richard Wheeler is here. Richard's new book on Butte is called The Richest Hill on Earth, and if you want the absolute history of Butte, pick up that book. He's sitting right there, and he's an amazing gentleman. There's all kinds of interesting people here tonight. Please come and look at Carol's Gicles and Clyde's collective work. Oh, we forgot a very important thing. You have to tell us about your little project. Okay. Carol has the coolest thing.
It's something that Clyde and I thought of about 20 years ago when we were hiking in Sedona, Arizona. And it was beautiful, red dirt, green, you know, the complementary color thing. And I looked at Clyde and I said, you know, this is kind of like snorkeling, only it's land snorkeling. And so we've been thinking about this and kicking this idea around for 20 years. And finally, our friend encouraged us to do something about it, and so we decided to start a website to encourage people to spend time in nature. And the whole idea of land snorkeling is you go outside in nature, and I don't know if anybody's experienced this growing up and going hiking with your parents, and your parents are saying, we're going to go up to Sacagawea. You know, and the kids are dragging and you're forcing them to do something that they really don't want to do. But the idea with land snorkeling is you go out with no destination in mind and you just wander and wonder about nature. And one breeds another question. And just to enjoy the beauty of nature and learning about it, and you will start, we've had 85-year-old women call us up and say, you know what? I've been land snorkeling. I got my whole bridge club to go out on the golf course and land snorkel. So we're just doing this as an idea, and kind of a basis was reading the Richard Louvre book, Last Child in the Woods, which was talking about, he coined the phrase nature deficit disorder, and how our children are spending less time out in nature, and this is not a good thing. Maybe, you know, I have no inclination to trash technology, but I think that the more time we spend out in nature, the more it feeds our soul, and that's one of the reasons why Livingston is so wonderful. People have that accessibility, and you have it here too, where you go out in nature and it feeds your soul and it feeds your creativity.
Do go to the website. There's stories on the website of people who have just gone out and looked down and discovered what was under their feet that they didn't even know was there, and they take photographs and write about it. And it is a terrific, it's actually perfect for this program, because it really does encourage people of a certain age to continue learning. So I just thought that would be a great thing to share with you all. Go and check out landsnorkel.com. If there's no other questions, we'll wrap it up and let you guys go home, because we got to go back to Livingston. Thanks so much.